But among them are black holes. Now, as we know, that's interesting because black holes have various difficulties studying them using normal GR methods. In particular, they have a singularity in the middle. They evaporate with corresponding paradoxes. And even the horizon is sometimes not as straightforward as it was thought to be. So from a traditional GR perspective, it's very hard to tackle any of these problems beyond the semi-classical regime, which generally doesn't capture the physics that we'd really like to understand. Now, the ADS-CFT correspondence in principle answers all the questions you want to ask of a black hole by stating that they're exactly describable as a finite temperature field theory. But that's in principle. Now, the problem is that the handle that we have on this finite temperature field theory is a weak coupling, and the black hole is in the strongly coupled finite temperature field theory. Now, so what you'd like to do, if you could, is study the weakly coupled theory and try to gain some insights about black holes like that. Now, of course, that will only be valid if there's no phase transition as you go from strong to weak coupling in the field theory. So therefore, if you want to understand how black holes fit into ADS-CFT, it's crucial to understand whether there's a phase transition or not as you go from weak to strong coupling at finite temperature. Okay, so that's what this talk is going to be about. And so here's an outline. I'm going to start with a very brief review of ADS-CFT. Then I'm going to talk about the phase structure of N equals 4 CPM mills at finite temperature. And in particular, I'll review some known results, which use the polyglot loop as an order parameter. And I'm going to talk about some new results, in which we've included the role of the six scalar fields of N equals 4 CPM mills theory. And in the way, okay, so what we're going to talk about is the vacuum structure of the theory on at finite temperature and on S3. And we're going to see how it describes in terms of the eigenvalues of various scalar fields. So it's an SUN Yang-Mills theory. Okay, so all the fields in the theory are N by N matrices. Okay, so if you diagonalize them, you have N eigenvalues. And so what we're going to be looking at are distributions of these eigenvalues. Okay, so the and I'll get to what that means. And so the different phases I'm going to be talking about are going to be characterized by different distributions of eigenvalues of the fields in the theory. And so in particular, and so we're going to have things like S1 times S5 or S6 appearing as distributions of these eigenvalues. So this S5 is going to be related to the six scalar fields, and this sort of S1 direction is going to be related to the polyglot loop, which is the A0, the time component of the gauge field. So after this discussion of the different phases, I'm going to talk about some theoretical speculations about what these eigenvalue distributions might be, and then I'll conclude. Okay, so just for the sake of completeness, let's have a one slide review of ADS-CFT. So ADS-CFT states that 2B string theory on all geometries that are asymptotically ADS-5 times S5 is supposed to be equivalent to N equals 4 CPM Mills theory on the conformal boundary, which is R times S3. So I'm working in global coordinates, okay, everything I'm doing. And so R is sort of is the time direction, and S3 is the boundary, the spatial boundary of ADS-5. Okay, now that's all very well, but it's useful if you want to calculate anything to take some limits of this correspondence. So one very useful limit is the large N limit, and where N is the rank of the SUN gauge group. The reason, well, that's Atuf told us a long time ago that that's a very useful thing to do in field theory, but it's also a useful thing to do in gravity because the ADS-CFT dictionary maps N to 1 over G string. So when we take N large, that's like taking G string small, so we can neglect higher loop effects in the string. Okay, so that's one parameter. Another parameter that appears in the theory is the Atuf coupling, which is N times G Yang mills, and that's a three-dimensional parameter. And so and that turns out to be related to the radius of the ADS space. And in particular, large lambda means that the ADS is weakly curved, which is when you can do gravity calculations. All right, so now let me get to the point. So this is the sort of arena in which this talk is going to take place. And so there are two parameters, okay? One is the Atuf coupling, and the other one is the temperature. Now, I'm going to sort of, we're doing the theory on S3 times S1, which is a thermal circle at finite temperature. And this T is a dimensionless temperature in which I've set the radius of this S3 to 1. So this is really R times T, okay, where R is the radius of the spatialness. And so what we want to see is what is the phase structure of the theory as a function of these two parameters, okay, temperature and coupling.
How crucial is this S3 and not R3?
It's pretty crucial.
So you'll get one more. scale?
That's right. So actually, because it's a conformal field theory, if you're in R3, the temperature is actually meaning all the temperatures are the same, because there's no other scale of the theory. So okay, so R3 is actually all the way to be sort of up here. So the limit of high temperatures, this S1 is much smaller than the S3, and that's when you reach R3. So it is actually on this diagram in the limit of high temperatures.
Yeah, but you can have R3 and low temperatures also.
No, but for a conformal field theory on R3, yeah, there's only one temperature. So actually, maybe I should say something else about that. So I mean, the R3 limit is actually quite subtle, because you sort of lose this directionless temperature in the limit, and it's not clear that that's a very continuous limit, for example. But in principle, it's up here on this diagram. Okay, so this question has been studied throughout for several years, and so the first small line on this phase diagram was by Hawking and Page. Before they even knew that they had what they were doing had anything to do with n=4 Sabine annular theory. And so what they were looking at was just a gravity in ABS space. Large coupling is where gravity is valid, and weak coupling is where we have a field theory description. And so this is the Hawking Page phase transition. And this maps, so down here is where ABS space, thermal ABS makes a dominant contribution to the partition function, and up here is where the ABS black hole makes a dominant contribution. So the black holes that we'd like to study are here, okay? And then Witten later reinterpreted this phase transition as a deconfinement phase transition, because the free energy of the theory jumped from being of order 1 down here to being order n squared above that line. Okay, then Sundborg in 1999 actually studied the free theory. And it's an interesting thing that there's actually a deconfinement phase transition in the free theory also. Okay, and this is crucially because it's on S3 and at large n. So we're always in the n goes to infinity limit, which is why there could be phase transitions on a finite volume at finite volume. And this first order transition is, again, the free energy jumps from order 1 to order n squared. And what's crucial, the crucial input to allowing this to happen is that you impose a gauge singlet constraint. Okay, so you have strings of operators, you impose a gauge singlet, you just weight the partition function by basically the length of the operator, and there's a Hagedorn phase transition in the free theory. So, and then Aharoni and Minwala and others extended this to finite but small coupling. And before, let me just say something about what I just drew. So they said there are actually two possibilities, and I've just drawn one of them. Okay. So once you go to small but finite coupling, this first order transition can do two things. It can either extend as a first order transition, or it can do the thing that I've drawn, or it can split into two, second and a third order phase transition. And to distinguish between these two possibilities, a certain parameter in the effective action needs to be calculated, and that requires a three-loop calculation that hasn't been done for n=4 theory. Okay? So I've just drawn one case for completeness here. But there are two possibilities. It could be just a single first order one, or a third and a second order one. Okay. But what these guys did, and I should stress that this paper is really the sort of starting point for the work that I'm going to talk about. It's a very nice paper. So then what they did is they classified that there are these two possibilities that can happen once you get to find their lab. But we don't know which one.
Is it still not known now?
It's not known. No. So they did the equivalent calculation for pure Young-Mills theory, and in that case, you get this.
Okay, because I saw the video something. I'm saying it's not the same.
So the points are following that there are all these various three-loop diagrams. They did all the ones with just gluons in them, and they give you one. But basically, all the diagrams contribute different signs to some parameter, so you don't know what's going to happen in the full theory. But yeah, for pure Young-Mills, this. Okay, so this is what's known. And so, of course, what you'd like to do at this point is just do some minimal interpolation between strong and weak coupling. So, and that's sort of where we got interested in this. So the question is, can anything funny happen as you go from weak to strong coupling in either of these phases? And I'm only going to be interested in this high temperature phase. And for me, that's the question, is how similar is the black hole, which is here, and the weakly coupled plasma, which is here.
So are you going to make an assumption that it's these two phase transitions?
No,
it's not relevant.
It's not going to be that relevant. This is a nicer picture, so in that case. In fact, what I'm going to say is not going to shed any light upon this. I mean, I think you just have to do this with the plasma, or something has to. Okay, so there's been a framework that's been developed, that people have been used, that have really led to this picture. Okay, and primarily in this paper. And so I've drawn some lines here, but you might ask, well, what is the order parameter? I mean, I've drawn some phase transitions, but what's happening as we go across these phase transitions? Okay, so the order parameter that people use is this polyphenol loop. So the polyphenol loop, I just remind you, is just the holonomy of the gauge field around the thermal time circle. Okay. And in fact, in practice, people just simply study the eigenvalue distribution for A0, the time component of the gauge field, times beta, which is whatever the temperature, it just makes it a nicer normalization. And so you take a spatially homogeneous and time-independent mode of A0. And so that's a matrix, okay, it's an n-by-n matrix, it's got n eigenvalues, theta p. And these take, actually, you can convince yourself that they take values in a circle. So what you have is that you have a circle, and then the eigenvalues of the matrix are some e to the I, theta p, they take values on this circle. You imagine sort of dividing into boxes, and you sort of put how many eigenvalues are there of each number, and in the larger limit, you get some distribution of eigenvalues on the circle, which maybe I can draw like this. So there's some distribution of eigenvalues along the circle, that's identified. Okay, so in the larger limit. Alright, so what you have is this eigenvalue, and that's something you calculate. So given some phase, given some coupling, given some temperature, you can calculate how the eigenvalues of this matrix, this A0 matrix, are distributed on the circle. And so now we can look at what these different phase transitions are. So for example, the deconfinement phase transition, the first order one, you have a uniform distribution in the circle, and it becomes non-uniform. Okay. So that's what happens here. Okay, and probably here. And then if there's a third order one, something else that can happen is that it can go from being non-uniform to actually developing a gap, so being exactly zero over some range. And that's a non-analytic process because we know that an analytic function can't be identically zero over some range. So this has to be a non-analytic function, but this one is analytic. So there's something non-analytic that happens when you develop a gap. And this, I'm going to call these generically Gross-Witten phase transitions. Okay, so these are sort of two things that can happen when you have an eigenvalue distribution on a circle. Are there any questions about that?
Why is it the case that, say, from uniform to the non-uniform, it corresponds to a
different time zone? Okay, good. So one order parameter for a deconfinement transition is in fact a polyphenol loop. So the vev of trace So this is a vev of the polyphenol loop. This is actually an order parameter for the confinement. So this is equal to zero in a confined phase, and it's non-zero in a deconfined phase. Okay. So when you have a uniform distribution of eigenvalues, so that's this matrix, this trace is actually zero. And when you can think of this, and on the non-uniform one, it's not zero.
You can think of the delta function p. Just have this kind of small.
Sorry?
If you break a symmetry,
yes.
Then you break it completely. You get only one value.
So this becomes a dot function in the high temperature limit, uh-huh. which is, I think, what also happened on R, which is the R3 limit. So it would become a dot function. Yeah. But just as you go above the transition, it's not. In fact, you can write this, so you can write the eigenvalue distribution in a sort of cosine series, right? okay, from the circle. And what happens here, okay, so sort of 1 plus. And what happens here is it lowers the first cosine mode, condenses. And in fact, this gap happens. So this is really just above the transition, this is 1 plus cosine, okay, some bump. And then what happens is some coefficient. And then when this coefficient gets big, then you get, then at some point you develop a gap when it hits, when it gets to zero. But as you're saying, at high temperatures, it becomes a delta function. Good. Okay. So now what I'm going to be doing is just complicating this story by also including the scalar, the variance of the scalar fields. Okay. So why didn't Aharoni and collaborators include the variance?
Well, sorry. So it is well established that there is a gross written
No. Okay. If depending on the sign, if the sign of this undetermined parameter that requires a free loop calculation is one sign, then it goes to
the thing. But I thought that you presented it that that mode condenses, the cosine mode condenses, and then it develops there. Then it becomes a non-analytic. So that's still a conjecture.
So
exactly what is established in these lines.
Okay, so it's established that there are two possibilities. So depending on the sign, so one possibility is that there's a second order transition in which this cosine mode condenses, and then eventually you develop a gap that's third order. The other picture is that there's a first order transition, and then you jump directly to from the uniform to a gap distribution. And it's just some different vacuum. And in that case, you're not condensing this cosine.
And so precisely whether it condenses or how it condenses doesn't change.
No, it depends on the sign of one parameter. That's not known. Yeah. But the two possibilities are established. Okay. So why did Aharoni et al. Neglect the scalar? So they had a very good reason to, which is that they were interested, this is RT, this is lambda, they were interested in looking at what happens near the phase transition, okay? And at these temperatures, the scalar fields have a mass, which is, they have a conformal mass, because it's a conformal field theory on an S3. And so you have a mass which is related to the radius of the S3. Whereas A0 is actually is classically massless. And in fact, A0 gets a one loop mass just from thermal. It gets a thermal one loop mass. But at these temperatures, this is much less than this. Okay? So it makes sense to integrate out the scalars and just think about this A0 field when you're here. Okay? At these temperatures, and at lambda much less than 1, this is much lighter than this. Okay? However, what I'm going to be talking about is going to happen at temperatures where these two masses are comparable. Okay, so where 1 over r squared is about the same as lambda t squared. Okay, and at these temperatures, or at these couplings, the masses of the scalar fields and the mass of the A0 field are comparable. So that suggests that we should consider a joint action in which we allow both A0 and phi, and this leads to the six scalar fields of the theory to get a pair.
The fermions are still very
Well, I don't know how to give them a pair without breaking this normal thing. And I want to give the vector fields that don't break symmetries at the back of space time.
But some bilinear quantum state, so it cannot, because you are a strong coupling.
No, I'm a weak. I'm going to be a weak coupling.
Oh, okay. So that's a condensate cannot.
So I think
cannot arrive by linear fermionic condensates cannot probably arrive.
I don't. Yeah, I think it's enough just to consider the fundamental fields. Okay, I'll show you what I'm doing in a second. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So what I want to do is I'm going to keep these gates, and basically I'm just going to write down a Coleman-Weinberg effective potential for A0 and also for the homogeneous, so the space-time independent modes phi j. Okay. And so that's the idea. So I'm going to integrate out the off-diagonal modes, which are the non-commuting modes, and I'm going to take an effective potential for the eigenvalues theta p and phi p, so the n of each of these. So this is kind of a big Coleman-Weinberg effective potential. And then once we've got the potential for all these eigenvalues, so it's going to be a capital potential, we just have to minimize them and find the eigenvalue distribution now in this six-dimensional space. Okay, it's six-dimensional because there are five of these and one of these.
Can you remind me of this conform of Mars? The usual one writes the action being a Mars slash.
So, good. So, in flat space, a scalar.
You are not in curved space.
Yeah, I am.
It's a curved space, Mars.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah, that's right. So, it's something like the Ritchie scalar over six. So, something like that is the conformal wave equation.
I guess I still don't understand. So in principle, when we write down the two actions, there will be fermionic fermions. So they will be massive, right? Because you have you have an anti-periodic boundary conditions along the temporal circle. So you can again integrate them out.
Yes.
So then it becomes a sensible question, irrespective of whether there is a VEBS or not. What's the correction to your own Weinberg type potential once you integrate out fermions?
Yes.
And whether that process is important.
So I am going to integrate out the fermions.
And you're saying that you can do.
So I think that in one loop, this is really just going to be one loop vector potential. That you can always treat the theory in terms of the fundamental fields and not worry about effects due to the condensated bilinears and composite operators.
Right.
I think in general, maybe beyond one loop, you do need to worry.
Okay, but that's one loop, and you will treat that.
I'm going to just integrate one after one.
Okay.
But actually, I'm going to have some caveats. So let me write down the potential, and then I'll discuss the loopholes. Okay. So, and I just wanted to make an aside here, because actually this whole formalism that I'm going to be using is very similar to formalism that's recently been discussed in the supersymmetric sector, N equals 4, by David Bernstein. And so David Bernstein is interested in 1/8 VPS. Operators in which you have where all the six scalar fields are potentially playing a role. And in fact, what he does is consider a matrix model for these six scalar fields, which ends up looking like this. So this is going to be, this would be sort of the mass term of the, this would be something like this term. And this log, and then there's a log repulsion between the six directions that comes from sort of van der Mond type measure factor, which I'll talk about more in a second. But I just want to say that he, this is his matrix model that he uses to discuss the sector. And this is going to be very, very similar to the ones that I'm getting. Except he's a strong coupling in the supersymmetric sector, and it's just different. But the point I want to make is that when you solve this matrix model, you find that these six scalar fields form, the eigenvalue distribution forms an S5. And David wants to say that this S5 is the S5 of the dual ADS5 times S5. Okay? So there's an emergent geometry that comes out when you solve from these eigenvalue distributions. And then you should try to think of this geometry as actually being part of the dual geometry. And the way he's thinking about it is a sort of a generalization of LLM. So in the LLM geometries, you have some eigenvalue on a plane that forms some droplet, and then and that gives you some sort of boundary data for your geometry. Okay, you've got some slice of the geometry in which some eigenvalue distribution gives you the geometry. And the idea here is that you can include in more directions. So this eigenvalue distribution is a higher dimensional slice of the geometry, in this case, S5. But if you had some other operator, you could consider doing this, putting the operator into the exponent. It would give you some extra interactions in this matrix model. You'd solve that. You'd find the modified geometry, not an S5, but something else. And then he would want to argue that new geometry you get is some subsector of the geometry dual to the trace operator. Okay? So I'm actually not working. Again, this is a strong coupling and so on. But I just want to say that formally, what I'm going to do is very similar to this. Okay. So that's just an aside. Okay, so to anticipate, this is what is going to happen. So in below the Hagedorn transition, okay, remember that there was a uniform distribution along the circle. Okay, so that gives you an S1. Right? And we're going to see that there's just an S5 sitting there. These scalars just sit and form an S5. But as you go through the Hagedorn transition, we're going to see that this becomes an S6, and then I'm going to argue that there's a new transition here, where this S6 collapses to an S5. Okay. But now we don't know what's happening there. So I'll show this plot again at the end, but that's just to orientate for the rest of this talk. Okay, So if you do what I said, which is find the one loop vector potential, so I'm allowing A0 and the six scalar fields to get the homogeneous mode and the six scalar fields to get a pair, and I integrate out everything else in one loop, I just get some determinants, okay? And this is the wonderful potential that you get. So let me just, so this is the classical mass term, okay? And then there's a one loop bosonic and fermionic determinants. These C's are just some Casimir. These C's are present even at zero temperature, and they're not going to play a big role. And then this sum over L are the sums over the spherical harmonics on the S3. Okay, so for each angular momentum, you get some determinant, and well, it looks like this. And so here's the dependence on the A0, and also on the theta. On the scalar fields. Okay, so phi is a vector. Okay, so phi goes from 1 to 6. So let me just make some comments about this, about its validity. So firstly, obviously, we have to build weak coupling, because this is a one-loop vector potential. Another thing that you have to worry about at finite temperature field theory is that there's a non-determinate scale in the game, which is a magnetic screening scale. Okay, so the magnetic mass is like lambda t. There's a magnetic mass scale, and it's known that at this scale there are important non-perturbative effects, okay, even at weak coupling. One way you can see that is that if you take the Lagrangian, for the 4D theory, and you reduce it. And you reduce it on the S1, okay, you get a 1 over temperature, okay, to integrate out. And then you've got a 3D theory of F squared, and this is known to be confining, and the confining scale is just that, which is T times lambda. Okay, so you know that in the static sector, there's some confining scale in the magnetic sector, okay, in the spatial sector of the theory, which is actually non-perturbative, but you can see it from this 3D theory. So what I want to do, that's a large distance scale, I want the S3 to always be smaller than this large magnetic confining scale, so that I'm staying away from these. So it's infrared, this is an infrared non-perturbative effect. If I take the S3 to be sufficiently small, okay, which corresponds to being at sufficiently low temperatures, then that's fine. We won't have any problems. Now, a crucial term in this potential I just wrote down is this log 1. Okay, and what this is actually a generalization of the van der Mond term that may be familiar. So if we put this phi equal to 0, then you just get log sine of theta pq, which is a normal van der Mond that comes from integrating over unitary matrices.
Sorry, pq is just a difference.
Sorry, yeah.
Okay.
No, I should have said that. Thank you. So this is a sort of a generalization of the van der Mond term that combines the scalars and theta. But what you see now is that this is repulsive in all directions. Okay. So if you want to take theta or phi to 0, it doesn't want to go to 0, okay? So this term is going to try to spread out the eigenvalues in all seven directions, which is why you get these distributions. Now, okay, so you asked about the fermions, but another thing you could have asked about are the higher harmonics on S3. And because of this conformal mass term, all the harmonics So the mass of the higher L modes is just some number, you know, like L squared or something, over R squared. Okay? So they have higher mass, but they're not parametrically separated, the masses of all these modes. So you might think that the correct thing to do is actually to write down the effective potential that keeps all of the higher harmonics on the S3, and that their dynamics may be important. And that may be true. But the philosophy here is that we just need to start somewhere, so we're starting with the homogeneous modes on S3, which is what you would normally do in a common Weinberg type potential, and and integrate out everything else. Okay. All right. And I'm going to define x to be beta times 5, okay, just rescale it.
So once you set them because of what you said, you pretty much ignore permanent because there is no other zero mode for them.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Okay, good.
I mean, again, I wouldn't know how to treat the fermions in terms of an eigenvalue distribution. I mean, just because they're
so it will be more complicated.
Yeah.
You would have to integrate out this method, as you said, the prime modes. It will be more complicated.
Okay, but I think I guess all I want to emphasize is that when you just include these scalars, you already see this homogeneous mode. You already see that there's some quite rich dynamics associated with these eigenvalue distributions, and so that's what I'm going to tell you about. Okay. So this is going to go in bits. Okay. So we have the phase diagram. And then more platforms. Right. Good. So we have the phase diagram. So I'm going to start here, and then I'm going to go off here. Okay. So let's start at low temperatures. So at low temperatures, which means when you're much less than this scale, so all the way down here, I said that we expected the mass of the phis to be much bigger than the mass of the A0 mode. Okay? So what that means is that we expect that the theta direction is going to extend much more than the phi direction, because the phi direction has a bigger mass keeping it in. Now what's the dynamics here? So the dynamics here is a log term that wants to make pairs of poles, and then it's a mass term that wants to keep the eigenvalues in. Okay, and this balance is what gives you the eigenvalue distribution. Alright, so what we do is, okay, so let's just to restate that. So at these low temperatures, we expect that the variance of the scalar fields are going to be less than the variance of the A0 field, okay, just because these guys have a much bigger mass. So what I do is I take those variance, which we're calling X now, alright, and they turn out to be proportional to lambda. And so to get the effective action, you can assume that and then check that it's valid later. And expand the action in lambda. Okay. And so what you find is that there's a first order term which only depends on theta. Okay, that's what you expect, okay, because theta is the important mode. Theta is determining the dynamics at these low temperatures. Okay. So you get some action for theta, and then at higher order you get an action. Once you know the eigenvalue distribution for theta, you plug it into this action and you get the eigenvalue distribution for the x's as well. Now this theta distribution is exactly the one that was found by Aharoni et al, and we know that it's uniform below the transition and non-uniform above. So given that, I now want to find the coupled distribution of the scalars and the non-scalars. So I just to stress, right, at these temperatures, the scalars are not playing any dynamical role, they're just tagging along for the right, okay, and the dynamics is determined by this theta direction. So just to quickly show how this is done, so you take a larger limit, that means that in the action, you replace all the sums by integrals, weighted by some eigenvalue distribution. And then in this limit, it turns out that the complicated action that I wrote before just becomes this, okay, at low temperatures. And so what's happening? So, there's some x squared term, and there's this is what became of the log term. Now, we're going to assume that the SO6 half symmetry is not broken. We have no reason to expect it to be broken, but you can do two tests. So all these S5 factors that I keep finding are there because they preserve SO6 half symmetry, okay, and S5 and SO6 are variant. What we did is we looked at the stability of those saddle points against R-symmetry breaking perturbations, and we found that they're stable against those perturbations. Now, they could, for some funny reason, be some other vacuum somewhere else that doesn't preserve SO6 R-symmetry, and if there is, then I don't know about it. Okay, but it may be there. But I'm going to assume that this SO6 symmetry is preserved. So then the ansatz, the most general ansatz that does that, is you assume, okay, so what have we got? So we had our circle, okay, we had the distribution of the theta eigenvalue distribution on a circle. And at each point on this circle, you have an S5, okay, which is the scalar eigenvalue distribution. And what happens is that S5 can change size as you go around the circle. Okay. So that's what this ansatz is saying, because you've got the radius of the S5 is a function of theta. That's how these distributions come.
But the distribution of scale is obviously homogeneous in S5.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's why I'm assuming in this sense.
But that's probably very reasonable because you restrict it to L0 anyway.
Sorry, I'm sure?
You restrict it to the homogeneous mode.
No, but I mean homogeneous on S5. Right? There are two spheres involved. There's S3, which is the spatial one.
Right.
And I'm taking what you listen to, but this is the S5. So the assumption here is that SO6 is not working. And we, as I said, we did some tests of this, and I think it's quite reasonable. So for example, okay, at strong coupling, the black hole clearly has an S5 in it, which is the SO6 invariance. If SO6 invariance is broken at weak coupling, there'd be another phase transition in between them, which would be a spontaneous breaking of our symmetry. So we're assuming that doesn't happen. So the solution, and it's quite nice, okay, so where does this come from? Well, you sort of see, here we have an x squared, and here we're going to have, and one rho, okay, and here we have rho squared and one x. So you might expect to get something like rho equals x, when you minimize this action, okay, roughly. And so in fact you do. And so the solution is that the size of this sphere, okay, that you have at each point on the S1 is actually equal to the density of eigenvalues on the S1. So what does that mean? So in fact, this is quite a nice consequence. So that means at low temperatures, below the phase transition, the distribution on the S1 was just constant, okay? You just had a uniform S1 distribution. So that means that the S5 also has constant size. So you just get S1 times S5 below the phase transition. Now, above the transition, the eigenvalue distribution is eventually gapped, okay? So it's got a gap in it. But what does that mean? That means that the size of the S5 goes to zero. Because remember, I'm saying that the S5, the radius of the S5 is equal to the gap, okay? So the radius of the S5 goes to zero at the endpoints. So the distribution is an interval times the S5. But this S5 is going to zero at the two endpoints. But this is actually equal to an S6, okay? So let's think of this. So we've got, imagine we have some circles, and we pinch off the circles at some endpoints of an interval, that's going to give you an S2. Okay. So we've got some circles. So the same thing is happening here. There's an S5 along an interval. But when the density of eigenvalues goes to zero, the S5 also shrinks to zero at the two endpoints. And that gives you an S6. Okay. So even though here the scalar fields are just going along for a ride, okay, their eigenvalue distribution is completely determined by the distribution of the thetas. What we have is there seems to be some sort of topology change as you're going through this hagadon, this deep and finite transition.
It's not real geometry, right?
I have some speculations at the end, but it's just eigenvalues.
Right, so at this stage, it's just what you did. You pretty much geometrize the global symmetry as physics.
That's right, yeah. That's
and then you just promote it into the geometry.
Yeah, I'm not saying.
It's not, if that would be the case in the.
Right, but okay, you might. I absolutely agree, but I mean, yeah. But it's kind of tempting to think, well, this is somehow the thermal circle in it. So you've got the S5, right? And then maybe this is somehow the thermal circle, and maybe it disappears, the black hole is formed. But it just works. Okay. So anyway, so there seems to be this interesting topology change that happens in the eigenvalue distribution as you go across this hang-on transition. And in fact, at some temperatures up here, so in general, we don't have an explicit formula for this row of theta, okay? It's hard to find it exactly. But there's some regime here where the temperatures are big but not too big, where this turns out to be given by this Wigner semicircle distribution. And in that case, you can show that the full distribution is actually an ellipsoid. Is there some points here where you get the, oh, sorry, so this S6 is not around S6. Okay, it's just topologically S6. And at some points here, you can show that it's an ellipsoid. But now, let me go to high temperatures, because this is where it's more interesting. So I want to be here, okay? And this is where we expect the scalar field in A0 to determine the dynamics on the equal role. And so you really have to solve the coupled problem. And in fact, you can show that the expansion that I did before breaks down, which assumes that the verbs of the scalar fields are much smaller than the verbs of theta, breaks down at these temperatures, and you have to have a coupled problem. And the effective action at high temperatures turns out to just be this. Okay. So what is this? So it's pretty simple, right? So we have a log. So this log term is some mega factor that wants to repel the eigenvalues in all six, in all seven directions. Okay. Whereas here, the mass term gives you an inhomogeneous attraction. Okay. So the x's have some mass coefficient, and the thetas have a different one. Okay. So, these are the dynamics. Okay. Repulsion and the mass that's not equal in two of the directions. So the equations of motion corresponding to this are these integral, in the larger limit, are these integral equations, which we don't know how to solve analytically. And I think this is something that I think is interesting about this whole area is that you get these equations, so these have been studied in two dimensions. So in quantum Hall, in the quantum Hall systems, or LLM, or droplet, you have a 2D, you have exactly this structure, okay? There's a mass term, which would be sort of the external magnetic field pulling the electrons together. And then you'd have a log term, which is the Coulomb force in two dimensions, okay? So in two dimensions, this would describe a bunch of electrons repelling each other in the external magnetic field. And that gives you, the ground state, it just gives you some circle in which the electrons form this droplets, okay? It's exactly this equation, okay, in two dimensions, but without thetas and with a 2 rather than a 6 there. And that turns out to be integrable, okay, in two dimensions. These high dimensional equations are, to our knowledge, not integrable, and it's an interesting question to develop some mathematical techniques to solve these. There's one more thing. Oh, yes, right. And one reason is they're a bit funny is that they're kind of the wrong force. So it's like lots of particles in six or seven dimensions interacting via a log pairwise force, which is not the Coulomb law in six or seven dimensions. So the natural force would be something like, I don't know, 1 over r to the 4 or something. But instead, we've got a log interaction. Okay, and that's what I think makes it interesting. Okay, so these are the equations I want to solve. By the way, the equations of Bernstein studies are exactly the same ones with no thetas. Without that equation. So, okay, because we didn't know how to solve these analytically, we did it numerically. So I'm just going to take these equations, so p and q depend on lambda, okay, they're the mass terms. Okay, so we solved it numerically, and here are some numerical plots of the eigenvalues. So I've plotted them at three different values of p over q, okay, of the relative masses. And so the black dot, so r is the size of the s phi, and f is theta, okay, it's a theta direction. And so what you find is that they're actually ellipsoids to a very high degree of accuracy, okay, so you take this, so let me explain various things here. So you just take this action, okay, what have I done? So I just take this action, I start with some random distributions, and I just do a relaxation numerically, and to try to find the minimum of the action, okay? And these are the distributions you get. So they're like 500 or 1,000 points, okay? So you put n equals 1,000, and you just solve it numerically, okay? What I want to say? Good. So there's some gaps here. So these thin black lines are a fit to the data of an ellipsoid, okay? So you take the extent in this direction, the extent in that direction, you fit an ellipsoid, and you find that it goes through all the points to two decimal places, right? So I think these are ellipsoids. Now, the reason I can't just take these equations and see if an ellipsoid solves them is that I need two data points. I need the shape of the distribution, but I also need the density of eigenvalues on the distribution, and it's almost certainly not uniform, but I don't know what it is. It's very hard to read off. For the numerics, you don't get a good reading of the eigenvalue density, so I can't check that these are exactly ellipsoids, but I think they are. Okay, so, and this gap here is because it's related to this. Oh, okay, not there. Basically, there's an S phi at each point, okay? And as r gets small, the S phi is getting small. So when you integrate over the S phi, you actually get fewer eigenvalues. And so there's a sort of effective gap you get that's small. It's just an effect of how you project the eigenvalues into two dimensions, is what I'm trying to say. There's no gap here. Okay, so you get these ellipsoids. What you might want to do is study their action. Okay, so I'm now going to plot the action of these ellipsoids as a function of cup. So we found the saddle, okay, I found the dominant saddle point, and I want to plot the action of this saddle as a function of kappa. Right? The reason I'm going to do this is there's actually another saddle. So another thing you can do is just put theta equals 0. If you put theta equals 0, I lose this term, okay? I set this term to 0, and I only have the 6 scalars. And there's always an S5 solution as well, okay? So there's going to be this S6, these ellipsoids I just gave you numerically, but there's also an S5 saddle, which is a delta function in theta, okay? So the theta isn't expanding at all. So now I want to plot the actions of these two saddles against each other, right? And so this is what you find. So, okay, forget about this line. This is some other random saddle. It's not important. These dots are the action of the ellipsoid saddle that I just calculated numerically. And this line is the action of the S5 saddle in which you don't excite the theta directions. Now, you would naively expect this S5 to have a higher action because this log term wants to repel everything in all 6 directions. And by taking this S5, you're forcing the theta direction not to expand. But okay, one should be open-minded, so you plot things, and you find that, okay, going this way in this plot corresponds to increasing the coupling. So if you fix the temperature going that way, going out in this direction, corresponds to going that direction on this plot. Okay.
And where are the limits of your validity?
Good. This is I'll zoom in a second. I'm within the validity here. So it looks like things are going to, something interesting might be happening here. So let's zoom in on this. So just to say again, so P over Q. Okay, so this line that I'm about to argue where they cross, okay, is going to be at this lambda, okay, and that's going to be much less than this magnetic signal. Okay. Right, so you zoom in and you find this, and that looks interesting because this seems to be suggesting that there's some merging of the ellipsoid saddle and this S5 saddle, okay. Alright, so this is the first indication, so it's just purely numerical. Okay, so I've got an S5 saddle that I have analytically, an S6 saddle that I found numerically, I've plotted their actions, and they seem to merge at somewhere between 0.7 and 0.8. It's also interesting to see what's happening to the eigenvalue distribution. So these are the actual distributions that you get in this as you go towards this limit. And indeed what you find is that the theta direction is collapsing. Now that's what you'd expect, actually, because down here, I found ellipsoids, but what they were very extended in the theta direction, okay, because theta was the more important eigenvalue pair. As you go towards this point, this ellipsoid starts squashing. There's some special value here where you actually get around S6. I don't know what that means, so there's some enhanced symmetry at some special point. Then you keep going, and this sphere starts, the ellipsoid starts squashing, and so it becomes more and more like a pancake. Okay, and that's what's happening here, this thing's squashing down. And then what seems to be happening is that it squashes entirely into an S5, okay, and some finite value of P and Q. This is numerical. Let me now give you an independent analytic argument that's happening. Okay?
Sorry,
yes?
Did you trace the plots of inference for Q or numerical dots and the S5s?
You mean the difference between this point and that line?
When we see, when you're talking about the merger, I want to see whether they are up and down, the rock points up and down, or they are consistently down.
Okay, so, yes, in fact, but the thing is, okay, so let me say a few things about this plot. So, You would never, so suppose that there were two saddles, okay, and it was still the first, just suppose it was the first order thing. These lines would not cross because the numerics always selects the lowest saddle, whatever it is, but I haven't told the numerics, find the S6 saddle, they're just finding the lowest one. So whatever, even if the actions of the two saddles cross, it's always going to follow the lowest one. Now what the numerics gives you is a lower bound for the action, because it's always going to be slightly above. So if you look at these points here, the dots are actually slightly above the line But that's just because we've got n equals 500, or in fact for these plots, I think it was like 100. So I think one should say the numerical accuracy is not going to be enough to see whether it's, say, a first or second order, or indeed no transition. Okay. But that's where this analytic argument comes in. Okay. So from here, you can't, I mean, it looks like something's happening, but you might say they're just getting very close. They're crossing or they're merging. Okay. You don't know. Okay. Although I think it's nice to see, I mean, that the eigenvalue distribution is collapsing in the feasible direction. So just to complement, so independent, and I'm going to give you an argument that's now independent of this numerical argument, okay? So what you do is you take the S5 saddle now. So we had two saddles, okay? So we had the S5 that was coming in up here, and then we had the S6 saddle. So I'm going to take the S5 saddle and just look at its stability. Okay, I'm going to do a stability now. I'm going to perturb it, right? And in particular, I'm going to perturb it in the theta direction. So theta was zero in that saddle. I put all the A0 eigenvalues to zero. So I'm just going to perturb it with the theta and see if it wants to open up or not. Okay. So we've got an action, we've got a saddle, so we can just perturb it. So if you perturb it, the action, the quadratic action for the fluctuations is this one. Okay. This is the classical mass term, okay, that you see theta squared, and this comes from the log term, okay, from perturbing. Because remember there was a log theta pq plus phi pq. So if you expand this with small theta, you get this effective mass term. This one's positive, this one's negative, and we want to see what happens, whether it's stable. So you can actually do this, you can look at this quadratic form and see if it has any negative eigenvalues. Okay. What you find is that up here, it's unstable. Okay. The theta wants to open up. And at a certain point, it becomes stable. And that's exactly as it turns out to be when q equals 4/3. So this would be p over q equals 0.75. Okay? So if we go back and look now at this plot, 0.75 would be about here. Okay? It doesn't look totally unreasonable. I mean, that which is roughly where these eigenvalues emerge. So what we see is that at the same point where the numerical S6 action seems to join. So one is coming from below, okay? At one point, when this action joins this, it's at about this value, say 0.75. And then following this saddle, okay, so that's completely independent of what we're doing with this saddle, we find that it stabilizes at about the same point, okay? So I want to say that that's some evidence that there's a second order phase transition, okay, that you have. So the picture would be something like so this would be the S5 saddle, this would be S6. There's actually only one. These two are actually identified by some permutation of eigenvalues. So there's an S5 and an S6 saddle, and then at some point the S5 stabilizes when it meets the S6. Okay. So that's the story. So I'm arguing that these two arguments taken together strongly suggest that there's a second order phase transition at this temperature, which, by the way, is exactly the electric mass scale of the theory, in which this S6 collapses to an S5.
Yes. If you could reverse the established, then I guess just from the, suppose we could do arbitrarily precise numerics, then we could really say that it is a second order phase transition if the instability occurs exactly at the point where the CN
is. Right, that's right. Yes.
So,
So it's not easy to do these numerics, right? Because you need to take 1,000 points and then relax them, and they have to converge.
What would happen if it would be a first order phase transition?
Oh, well, then you wouldn't have seen, then the S5 would always be stable locally. So if it was first order, right?
Or it would be unstable, but at a different point. Then it would be just some more complicated stuff.
Okay, so there could be a second order one very quickly followed by a first order one.
But that's complicated. Yeah.
Okay, the minimal interpretation of these two arguments is that there's a second order one. Okay. And so this is actually related to this delta function. So what's happening, if suppose you didn't want to think about the S5 and just looked at the polyphone loop, what's happening, that's saying is that this bump is becoming a delta function at some finite temperature, okay, not just in the asymptotically high temperature limits. Okay, so that would then lead us to this picture, in which, so now to sort of summarize what I just said, that at weak coupling, we've sort of added some more structure to this Hagedorn transition to say that there's a topology change from S1 times S5 to S6. And then I've argued that as you go across, in fact, exactly 1 over square root lambda, this S6 direction collapses to an S5. Okay. So this would be a phase transition that actually separates the strong and the weak coupling regimes. Now, where this calculation was valid was sort of around here somewhere. Okay, so you might ask what happens as you go to high temperatures and also as you follow it down. So obviously, if you naively extrapolate this formula, it's going to meet this line at about lambda equals 1. Okay, so obviously, we don't have any control over what's happening at lambda equals 1. But one thing that's pretty, I think, there is that, so what could happen? All right. Well, it could go out a strong coupling. But there's certainly no evidence of a second order phase transition in the black hole background. Okay, it could, I guess, go up to infinity, or it could just hit this line and join it. Okay, so a minimal thing for it to do is just to meet this line. And then as you go up here, as you go up to high temperatures, well, several things could happen. It could go like this and reach sort of the T equals infinity theory at some finite lambda. It could go like that and reach the lambda equals zero theory at some finite T. Or we could sort of follow up and go up to the corner of the phase diagram, as it were. I think this is by far the most likely, because at lambda equals zero, the scalars don't condense at all. Okay, so this phase transition just doesn't make any sense in the free theory. And also, in the R3 limit, the scalars also don't condense. So I don't really see how this could continue to R3. So the most likely thing is that it sort of goes up to the corner of the phase diagram. But obviously, I don't know. Okay, so that's the diagram. So I can just quickly say, so everything I've said so far has been calculations. Okay, these are just speculations, and quite imprecise speculations for that matter. Yeah.
So this has to be fully known. So this S6 must be singular, right? I mean, so it's not round as 6, but if I am to put a metric on it, it necessarily must be singular because you have, because it's S5 cross S1.
Oh, I'm sorry. I should say something about this. No. So okay. At high temperature, okay, in this high temperature limit, is actually everything is really happening on R7, and that's because all these thermal masses are getting big, all the eigenvalues are localized on the S. So there is an S1. So it's S1 times R6 would be the sort of space where the eigenvalues live. But at high temperatures, this eigenvalue distribution is very localized on the circle. So everything's happening in some here and then on some blob on the R6. So it's effectively R7. So it's just a. It's exactly as
okay.
But let me say something else there. You might wonder, so in two dimensions, in this quantum Hall droplets, the eigenvalues actually fill out a region. You might say, well, why are we getting these hypersurfaces? Why don't you just get a ball, right, with the eigenvalues just filling in? I mean, I've said that S5 is what was compatible with our symmetry, but actually the ball filled in S5 would also be compatible with our symmetry. And you can actually show that the eigenvalue distributions have to be singular, in fact. This is David Bernstein's argument, which I won't review, but I just want to say that you can show, and it's related to the fact that you have the wrong force law, the fact that you have this log interaction in six dimensions. You can show from that the eigenvalues have to form hypersurfaces. They can't form smooth distributions in six dimensions. All right. Well, I just wanted to say, I mean, really, it's a very short speculation, because I just want to say that it's nice that there's an S1 in the geometry where there's not a black hole and there's not a S1 where there isn't a black hole. And in fact, if you really wanted to push the geometry, this S1 should be tedial to the thermal S1, but it's actually a winding. It's a winding direction. And this S6 that you find, you might be think is reminiscent of the near horizon geometry of some localized vertebrates, which is what conceivably might make sense, because if you have, you should really think of the geometry being tedial to this thermal spectrum, if that makes sense. So maybe this S6 has something to do with vertebrates, but I don't really want to say. I don't have anything serious to say about this. Except that something similar happened. Okay, so there's a paper by Acheroni, Shiraz, and Wallen, and Toby Whiteman, which looked at the granular flag instability in terms of eigenvalue distributions. And there, it was on the, around the spatial circle. And there, you can tedialize along the spatial circle. And a non-uniform versus a uniform distribution was interpreted as localized versus smeared frames around some circle. Okay. So just let me just conclude. So I said that finite temperature n equals 4, 3 on S3 should be described by joint eigenvalue distribution for A0 and for the 6 scalars. About different phases are associated with different eigenvalue topologies. That through the Hagedorn transition, there's an S1 times S5 goes to S6. And at high temperature, there seems to be a new second order phase transition, separating weak and strong coupling, which takes S6 to S5. Okay, so what is this good for? So, well, one thing this may be good for is that some people, such as Schaefer et al., want to trace a big black hole to weak coupling. Okay, so there's some signature of correlators that's meant to tell you that you're in a black hole background. Well, what this says is that if you want to find the black hole of weak coupling, so suppose that there are no other, I'm not actually sure how likely this is, but suppose there are no other phase transitions in this picture. That would tell you that this S5 geometry is the one that continues out to the black hole. But at very, very weak coupling, this S5 is actually unstable. It's an unstable support. It's here. So for example, if you wanted to see the signatures of the black hole of weak coupling, you'd better look in this saddle, not in this one, okay? Because these ones come in from the complex plane and appear at this point. So actually, in some ways, well, okay. So if this is true, then the black hole is still there at very weak coupling, but it's going to be a bit more subtle to find it than you might have thought otherwise. Of course, you could also look for the black hole just here, but just on the other side of this phase transition, perturbation theory is still valid. And so again, you could look for the black hole there. Okay, that's all.
Then let's thank the speaker again.